From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For a week, the country breathlessly followed the events unfolding in Boston, led and in some cases misled by national media coverage.
Where the media got into trouble was during the long lulls when there really wasn't much going on.
News or noise coming up, and domestic workers and their employers get up close and personal in a program designed to help mediate disputes.
This program helped give me the tool to advocate for myself. I am talking to my customers more like the same level.
And Claudia Lopez makes her living photographing world-class climbers, but she volunteers helping injured climbers get their confidence back.
She'll spend all day hanging on a rope at 10 degrees, get people psyched to pose for the camera and look. She's a tough girl.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The nation is still recovering from the Boston Marathon bombing that killed three people and injured more than 100 others. The bombing and the manhunt that followed kept the entire country glued round the clock to media coverage. With so much conflicting information flying around in a city in lockdown, how did the media do in keeping the public informed? That's the topic for this week's News or Noise segment, where we take a look at media matters that involve misunderstanding and sometimes misinformation. To help us separate the news from the noise in the coverage of this dramatic case, we're speaking to Dan Kennedy now. He's a journalism professor at Northeastern University in Boston, and he joins us by phone from his office. Welcome to Latino USA, Dan.
Thank you, Maria. Nice to be here.
So, Dan, with all of the coverage, looking back now on what was done right, what was done wrong, how much of what we got in this coverage was, in fact, news, well done, or how much of it was noise that confused the issue?
When there was actually news breaking, I thought that the media, for the most part, did quite a good job. The Boston Globe, in particular, was very good. Local television was very good. Where the media got into trouble was during the long lulls when there really wasn't much going on. And that's when speculation and rumor tended to take over. And some of the failures that we've all been talking about for the past week really kind of took place in those dead spaces between actual news breaking out.
What specifically are you hearing in terms of the problems that came up then?
The most talked about mistake took place on Wednesday afternoon when CNN, the AP, the Globe, the Boston Herald, the other daily paper here, and a variety of other news sources all reported that two people had been arrested, and nothing of the kind had happened.
Wolf, we have information. An arrest has been made in the investigation
here
in Boston.
So the suspect that was identified has now been arrested.
I was told by a Boston...
That was remarkable, the extent to which some news organizations were reluctant to back down from that. I mean, it was all based on anonymous sourcing, but apparently they believed that their sourcing was so good that they just couldn't believe that they were wrong. In fact, they were wrong, and I think that that misinformation, at least for a short period of time, did a real disservice to the public.
So, Dan, I was with a group of Latino college students. They had some really critical observations of the mainstream media, including NPR, including other television news networks. They said that they felt that there was a kind of immediate assumption, finger-pointing to Islamic fundamentalists. What about these critiques from young Latino college students saying, you know what, we're not so sure about how well the media did here?
You know, there has been a bit of that. But I think that the media acted with some restraint in terms of finger-pointing in this case. I think they deserve a little bit of credit. Now, I must say, during some of these long lulls, when people are just trying to fill the silence, you did start to hear some speculation.
It's clearly a terrorist attack. Now the question is, who's the perpetrator? I know there are some early reports now of, for example, one Saudi national may be in custody. The New York Post is reporting that. Others are not confirming.
Yes, so maybe this is Islamic extremist terrorism of some sort, or maybe this is like a Timothy McVeigh situation of domestic right-wing extremism of some sort. And at least based on the early indications, the two bombers, I should say one of them is a suspect, the other is dead, it doesn't really seem like it neatly fits into either of those categories. These seem to be more loners with perhaps not all that much of an agenda other than their anger at the world. So that does kind of fall into the unfortunate speculation that the media engaged in when they should have just stuck with what was playing out right in front of them.
So now that one of the alleged bombers is in custody, what's your sense of how the media has been doing in terms of the analysis of the events?
Well, I think now we're in kind of another danger zone, and I've been monitoring Twitter off and on, and it seems like every hour or so there are a couple of more revelations. This all comes unsourced, but we're hearing that the bombers got their information on how to make a bomb from an Al-Qaeda magazine. We're hearing that they became angry over the U.S. involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you just kind of sit back and say, well, how much of this is going to be corroborated and how much of this are we going to see the media backing down from in the days ahead? I mean, right now, there's just no way of knowing, and we'll have to see.
So overall, Dan, coverage of this event, what's your sense of the ratio of news to noise?
I think that when there was actual news happening, I don't think there was a lot of noise. And during the lulls, and we're now in another lull, my sense is that based on some of the things that have happened in the past, we're probably going to find out that a good deal of it is noise. I hope not, but that tends to be what we see in these situations.
Dan, thank you so much for helping us elevate our news literacy quotient. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Maria. I appreciate your having me.
Dan Kennedy is a journalism professor at Northeastern University. He joined us by phone from Boston. We have another story out of Boston now. This one is about a group of people who almost never come to national attention. Domestic workers, nannies, house cleaners, home health aides. Their jobs often call for a close bond with the people they work for, but most don't have basic labor protections, and there's no system for resolving conflicts. A new initiative in Massachusetts is part of a growing national movement to change that. Shannon Mullen reports.
It's after hours at a business park north of Boston. Sonia Suarez is here alone cleaning an office. She's a 52-year-old immigrant from Brazil. Suarez runs her own cleaning service. She comes here once a week.
Tonight I'm collecting all the trash, I'm dusting all the tables, vacuum washing the floor, washing the bathroom, the kitchen.
Suarez has been doing domestic work since she came to the U.S. in 1985. She was a mechanical engineer in Brazil. But for most of her adult life, she's been cleaning houses and taking care of other people's kids, and she takes a lot of pride in her work. A few years ago, she abruptly parted ways with a family she worked for 18 years. Suarez says it was just a personal misunderstanding.
They didn't even say goodbye to me or thank you, and all because one minor incident. So I felt like one chunk of me was taken away, and they disregard that.
Suarez didn't have the confidence to speak up for herself, but that was before she found the Domestic Worker Mediation Project. It started last fall at the Brazilian Immigrant Center in Cambridge. Now Suarez is one of 3 dozen domestic workers and employers the project has trained. The idea is to resolve disputes through mediation instead of legal action.
Raise your hand if you like sweet foods better than salty foods.
The trainees get more than 30 hours of instruction spread over 4 weekends. Attorney Lydia Edwards directs the project and helps run the workshops.
We expect you to bring as much of the gifts and talents that you have to the table.
Edwards says the program is the first of its kind in the country. It works like this. Say a nanny calls for legal help with a dispute. The center reaches out to the employer to offer free mediation. If both sides agree, they meet with a pair of mediators, one who's a domestic worker and one who's an employer. The process is not about finding fault, Edwards says, but about finding a resolution.
We're trying to come up with ways in which workers can advocate for themselves in a very unique industry where in many cases the laws aren't even there to protect them.
There are about 2.6 million domestic workers in the U.S. Almost all are women, according to the National Domestic Workers Alliance, an advocacy group based in New York. More than two-thirds are immigrants, and almost half of those are undocumented. Domestic workers are not protected by many federal labor laws. The industry has no union. And when it comes to speaking up, Alliance campaign director Andrea Mercado says most workers don't because they're afraid to lose their jobs.
The aim is for this work to be seen as a profession, you know, and something that's deserving of respect and dignity and basic labor protections.
Mercado says that means changing attitudes and policy. That's starting to happen. New York now has a domestic workers' bill of rights on its books, and there's similar legislation in the works in Massachusetts and 4 other states.
Even for it to be talked about, I think, is a real departure from where we were a decade ago.
The immigrants' rights movement has taken up the cause, but it's also a women's rights issue, says Lydia Edwards at the Mediation Project.
There's some women who would fight like hell against the glass ceiling at their corporate job, and then turn around and treat their nanny like she's nothing. A female employer will swear up and down she's not going to pay her nanny because while her children were napping, the nanny wasn't working. That's the go-to argument. I've also had people tell me, well, she enjoyed trick-or-treating with my kids. I'm not paying her for it. That wasn't work.
So far, the project has dealt with more than 40 cases, and Edwards wound up litigating most of them. She says those conflicts went past the point when mediation would help, but 5 cases did go through mediation and succeeded in avoiding the courtroom. Edwards thinks as word gets around, more workers will call in sooner. Sonia Suarez agrees.
The very first day I left feeling like, oh my God, you know, why this program was not exist like 27 years ago?
Suarez says some of her clients have noticed a difference in her since she became a mediator.
This program helped give me the tool to advocate for myself, not only for others, but for myself. I am talking to my customers more like the same level. I brought myself up to their level.
Suarez says the training alone gave her that, and she thinks all domestic workers should get it, whether or not they actually go on to become mediators. And enough workers are asking for it that the project is planning special training to help them speak up for themselves, right on the job. For Latino USA, I'm Shannon Mullen in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Coming up on Latino USA, Claudia Lopez was the first Colombian woman to scale the peaks of the Himalayan mountains. She knows the courage it takes for a disabled person to test themselves climbing.
I believe that it's a very strong transformational process that you go through when you are allowed to do something that you did not even consider that you could do or even wanted to do, and all of a sudden you are there.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, in our Radio Nature series, we go to the famous ice walls of Ouray, Colorado. That's where we meet photographer and mountaineer Claudia Lopez and an extraordinary group of climbers, all physically disabled in some way. Julia Schatz has our story.
The precipice of a frozen waterfall is one step away, but Claudia Lopez is unfazed.
This is a nice burly rope.
Her rope, knotted to a tree nearby, stretches as Claudia leans back to get a better shot. Claudia is photographing 31-year-old Wendy Ong, who is about to descend into an icy gorge in Colorado's Ouray Canyon. 3 years ago, Wendy fell 140 feet rock climbing. That left her with partial paralysis in her left leg and traumatic memories. This is Wendy's first rappel down an ice wall since then.
There you go, good.
She's standing near the ledge, checking her rope over and over again with volunteer Doug Shepherd.
That's fine. That's pretty...
I'm pretty risk averse these days.
No, I understand.
Wendy inches backward. The crowd below cheers. So does Claudia, her camera ready.
Enjoy the ride. It's always fun.
Claudia makes a living photographing world-famous mountaineers, but capturing the catharsis of people recovering from injury is a labor of love. Claudia has been taking pictures at the Paradox on Ice event here in Ouray for the last 4 years. Most of the climbers at Paradox are amputees or paralyzed. Ice climbing challenges them to define life by their own terms, destroying any notion that missing a limb makes them disabled.
I believe that it's a very strong transformational process that you go through when you are allowed to do something that you did not even consider that you could do or even wanted to do, and all of a sudden you are there.
For Claudia, Paradox on Ice is an essential reminder of her own experience. She was 21 years old and living in her native Colombia, putting her life back together after serious drug addiction. Her aunt took her in and introduced her to rock climbing. Halfway up her first route, Claudia froze.
Lots of fears just got to me, and I decided that I needed to come back down. And she said, no, the only way out is up.
After a tantrum that she now winces at in recollection, Claudia finished the climb. The fear was gone and replaced with a sense of purpose.
In certain terms, I was able to connect my mind with my body and be able to understand that my body could take me places that my mind could explore and learn a whole lot.
Just 1 year after that first climb, Claudia's aunt died during a fall in Suesca. Claudia threw herself into climbing. She climbed peak after peak in Europe, New Zealand, and Alaska. Claudia became the first Colombian woman to summit in the Himalayas. Back in Ouray Canyon, Claudia is dangling on a static rope about 70 feet off the ground. The injured climbers hack their axes into the canyon's ice wall. They look like praying mantises as they slowly ascend. Nick Watson, a volunteer, is holding Wendy Ong's rope from below. She's almost at the top.
All right, Wendy, you're getting close. Nice work.
Everyone looks up at Wendy as she tops out on a gorgeous pillar of ice. Her climbing instinct is back.
Are you coming down? Let's get a little cheering section here for Wendy. Yeah, Wendy!
Claudia snaps a photo. One more Paradox event and one more transformative experience. She's already planning her next adventure. Afghanistan. For Latino USA, I'm Juliana Schatz in Ouray, Colorado.
Folk singer and poet Violeta Parra helped revive Chile's traditional music, incorporating it into Nueva Canción, modern songs of politics and protest. Violeta's explosive vitality comes back to life now in a film, Violeta Went to Heaven. The unconventional biography is based on a memoir written by Parra's son, Ángel. The film won the Sundance World Cinema Jury Prize last year, and it's playing this month in theaters across the country. Latino USA producer Andres Caballero talked to the director, Andres Wood, when he was here in New York.
So let's start by talking about Violeta's character. Describe her for us just as you see her.
She wrote thousands of songs and she didn't know how to write or read music. She was one of the first feminists, I would say, in Chile. She was very strong, very direct, she has this mission that was to show the culture of her country to the world, and nobody won't stop her but her. In my opinion, is the most original Chilean artist.
The film is structured around the recreation of a 1962 interview. It's intertwined with flashbacks of her life, but not quite chronologically. What brought you to this approach?
She was so big in a way, and that was impossible to try to put her on one movie. You don't have to be expert on Violeta Parra to enjoy the movie, I think. And that's why, because Violeta Parra, in a way, represents a lot of women. So we decided that structure because we knew that we have to leave a lot of Violeta Parra professional artist and personal life out of the movie.
Violeta Parra is played by Chilean actress Francisca Gavilán, who also sings and performs most of the songs in the film. This one is called Volver a los 17.
Eso es lo que siento yo en este instante fecundo. Se va enredando, enredando como en el muro la hiedra.
Did you plan to have her interpret the songs from the very beginning?
Francisca brought a lot to the movie. We didn't ask her to sing, but in the middle of the process, we decided that she will sing. In a way, we create our own Violeta Parra that is not similar to, but has a sort of the similar spirit in our heads, you know.
Now, I've read several reviews. Most of them have been great, but I've also come across comments that people wish they could have seen more of her fight for social justice. What are your thoughts?
She was very political. Even though she will belong to a party, to a communist party, she will participate in campaigns. And in my opinion, the most political action that she did in her life was to travel through her country and collect folk. And for me, there's no more political thing than that.
Andrés Wood is the director of Violeta Went to Heaven, playing this month in theaters around the country. And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, call our listener line at 646-571-1228. You can also friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, where we are Latino USA, all one word. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Michael Simon Johnson, and Michael Jones. We had production help this week from Mark Jones and Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
News or Noise is funded by the Why News Matters initiative at the McCormick Foundation, fostering communities of educated, informed, and engaged citizens. Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. This is NPR.